many contexts in the global south, are really a sandbox for kind of tech companies to play in, to experiment with kind of new tech. And rather than hitting pause and saying, okay, maybe we do need some more regulation before we deepen or extend kind of these services, too often the solution that comes to hand is more tech.
Tech for Good is a relatively new movement where companies develop technological solutions to take on big societal or environmental problems. They can do this to improve their image in the eyes of their consumers, but also under the notion that making a profit and doing social good is not necessarily mutually exclusive. But is that last part true? And what happens when private companies become the drivers of social change? That's the question we're asking in this DEES podcast. Today we travel to Brazil and Paraguay to learn how so-called fintech companies have given poor people access to credit cards and life insurances that were once unobtainable to them. All they must do is give up extensive amounts of very private data about spending patterns and family relations. In the studio with me today is Caroline Schuster, who's an associate professor in economic anthropology at the National University of Australia, and Marie Colling, an anthropologist and senior researcher at DEES. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Have you heard of the name Nubank? Hopefully, the answer is yes. And if not, this might change soon because this Brazilian startup is disrupting the banking industry in Latin America. With the goal to make banking easier for all, this fintech now has more than 48 million users and soon might be worth north of $50 billion. But how did Nubank disrupt?
New digital tools, algorithms, and huge amounts of data on marginalized groups. This has enabled the global credit industry to offer loans to all those struggling to make ends meet. This has been especially visible in Brazil. Here, digital banks and mobile apps have given the country's poor population easier access to small and fast loans. Marie Colling has done fieldwork in Brazil among women who are dependent on credit cards to make a daily living. During your fieldwork, you met a woman that you call Dina. Could you tell us about her?
Right, so during fieldwork, I got to know Dina, who lives with her parents on the west side of the city. And just further down the street lives Gina's sister with her husband and young child. And everyone in Gina's family have very low income jobs, and they all struggle from time to time with unemployment. And so throughout Gina's life, she has always, there's always been a shortage of money in her family. And they've always been, I mean, so that means being behind on paying the bills, including the electricity bills. So throughout her life, there's been a reoccurring event of being stuck at home in the dark because they didn't manage to pay the electricity bills. And that means the company sent their guys to cut off the electricity until they managed to pay. And this had happened recently when I first met Gina during the field work, and it had also happened to her sister. So her sister and her family had to come and stay with at Gina's house for 5 days until they managed to make a payment arrangement and pay the first installment of that arrangement.
So money is obviously tight for Dina and her family. What role does credit cards play in making ends meet for her?
Yeah, so she was really excited that when we talked the first time, she had just managed to get a hold of 2 credit cards because she had recently become employed. So making a very low salary, but because of the salary, she was able to clean her name. So in Brazil, when you fall behind on debt payments, that means people easily get what is called a dirty name, which means that they're registered in the sort of with the credit bureaus as bad payers. And that's actually a term that dates back from before there were even banks in Brazil, where people would lend money from loan sharks at the local square. So if they didn't pay up, they would get a dirty name in the square. But that has sort of stuck. So that's still how people refer to being bad payers, that is, to have a bad name. But today, it's not actually that people's names are registered as bad payers. It's their number that they're registered with the tax authorities, which is called the CPF.
So for Dina, getting a credit card meant not just that she was able to provide for herself. Her whole family, parents, sister, and her sister's children, are also dependent on the credit. And once Dina managed to clean her name, she didn't even have to contact a bank herself to get a new credit card.
Right, so she didn't even know how they had her number, but the day after she cleaned her name, she received a call from a big fintech, a digital bank, offering her a credit card free of charge, which she was really excited about because she was short of money and really needed the credit. So this is what I've encountered a lot in my fieldwork in Brazil, that credit is really attributed with a lot of optimism. And in Gina's words, this, you know, credit is what saves her and her family all the time.
But how was her name cleaned in the first place?
Well, so that means paying up a sufficient amount of debt to get out of that register. But what's very characteristic of Gina and her family and a lot of the people I have met in Brazil is that because they're always short of money, they depend on credit for everything, really. To buy groceries, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, everything is bought on credit. And for that reason, there are always bills to be paid and they're always sort of struggling to make the deadlines for the different invoices and keeping track of all the different installments because usually, so this is also what she explained, what saves them is not the credit in itself, but also the fact that with a credit card, you can split up any purchase in multiple installments so that a big amount becomes a small amount. But that also means that there are a lot of payments to keep track of, and it's quite easy to fail and miss out on one of them. And then that's when people then so easily get a dirty name, also for very, very small amounts, but which can have quite huge consequences.
All right. So these loans seem to make Dina's life easier in the short term. But what are the long-term consequences of this for Dina?
Well, so first of all, there's that juggling of debt all the time. Taking one loan to pay another loan, constantly having to measure, like, how much credit do I have left, and trying to combine, you know, what money's coming in to pay off these debts, and that usually doesn't add up so nicely. And why she was also so excited that she managed to get the credit cards was that during the pandemic, she was unemployed, her dad was unemployed, they were really struggling through the pandemic, and at the end, they just had no more, you know, they had no more places to go to get credit, and so they ended up having to go to the loan sharks, which for many of the women I've talked to, that's sort of seen as a last resort, because these are not very nice people, and they charge really, really high interest rates. So they charged 20% on a 1,000 reais loan, which took them forever to pay off. So one thing that's very characteristic of these families is that they're not only struggling with, you know, lack of income and low income, but also that they always have these debt payments. So poverty today is not only about people's low income, but also, I mean, how little they earn, right? But also how much they owe. And that, I think, is often a very overlooked aspect of poverty in contemporary Brazil.
So for Dina, is this credit card industry a step up from the previous days when she had to go to the loan sharks and stuff like that?
Exactly. So it's seen as something really exciting on the one hand to be included in this credit economy. That's also how it's presented by the people I've talked to in the credit economy offering this credit, right? They're really doing people a huge favor because being short of money, the way to compensate is to buy things on credit. And so that's not only for, you know, emergencies and everyday emergencies, but also if people want a new phone and or other things that sort of improve their household, like improve their home. So anything that will also give people a sense of, you know, now I'm progressing in life, as they will say themselves. This is an expression people use. So there's a lot of optimism around credit. And then what I'm looking into is sort of the less optimistic side, exactly what is it doing in the long run? Because this credit comes at a high price. The interest rates are really high. And there's no room for negotiation here. The people who are in the most precarious conditions, they also pay the most expensive price for the credit that they're able to take on. So it really causes a further economic deprivation in the long run. But what I found is that people know that these are the conditions for them to be part of, modern consumer society. There's nothing to do about it. So there's not a lot of conversation around, the injustice of this system or, that the poor pay the more for their credit. This is just how it is.
Driving a taxi all day long is what Joel Alves, a 67-year-old Brazilian, has been doing for the past 22 years. But now he can't make ends meet anymore, let alone paying off his debts. With prices rising 10.79% from a year ago, driven by a jump in gasoline and food costs, and key interest rates at 11.75%, Joel is caught in what he sees as an endless debt trap.
Dina's story is not unique. In fact, credit cards are the most popular means of accessing credit for Brazilians. But it is also among the most expensive. This has contributed to Brazil's current debt crisis, where almost 80% of the adult population are now registered as being behind on their debt payments. South of Brazil lies the Republic of Paraguay. Though the two countries are very different from each other, they have at least one thing in common: huge problems with poor populations who are being excluded from the official economy. As part of the effort to give poor people access to financial services, the government in Paraguay introduced a fully paid life insurance in 2017 for low-income households. This was all mediated through private insurance companies. As part of her research, Caroline Schuster went to Paraguay. Here, she interviewed both the people working for the insurance companies and the people who were supposed to be helped by the new insurances. She also interviewed the social workers working with the poor families in Paraguay. Caroline, could you tell us, how did these new insurances come about?
Before I do that, I want to echo what Maria said about the kind of financial situation in Paraguay, which is really similar to Brazil. Most of the low-income families that we're talking about were also living on credit. In Paraguay, the common term for that is bicycling credit. So you're turning the pedals of the credit wheel round and round as you pay off one loan with the next. So that sort of over-indebtedness is ubiquitous in the region and is part of the other side, should we say, of the democratization of finance, as we're expanding financial services to include people who had previously really been shut out of those services. It also puts a lot of pressure on those households to keep up with the payments and to keep the credit bicycle kind of going. So the life insurance is part of that story, because in Paraguay, this all came about because of a national strategy for financial inclusion, which the government saw as a priority area to extend the benefits of being included in the banking system to people who'd been previously shut out of that. And that was not just through credit arrangements like the credit cards and microcredit loans that we were talking about, but also new financial services like insurance. And up to that point, very few low-income people had access to kind of even basic health or kind of life insurance policies. And so it was really an area that the social welfare state in Paraguay saw as an opportunity to bring together kind of public priorities and resourcing around social welfare on the one hand, and the deepening and extending of financial services and markets on the other hand.
The new life insurances gave people who previously had no safety net just that: a system promising to catch them financially in case they lost a loved one. to make this happen, the insurance companies needed a lot of data on people's income and relationships to be able to price the policies and pay out claims. This data was collected by the state's social workers. But fitting people's lives into the data systems was no simple task. And when the complexities of life didn't fit the data systems, people's safety net failed.
The data are kind of being captured by the social workers and kind of digitized, often by hand, based on kind of really complex records. So their interest in looking after their beneficiaries is to make sure the kids are going to school, to make sure that the household is going well and that they're accessing kind of different services, to kind of make sure that they're kind of checking in regularly around kind of mental health kind of questions and issues. And yet each one of those encounters is creating this paper trail that needs to be turned into a database. And that has the kind of effect of really making the sort of job of these social workers kind of two-faced, as it were. Kind of on the one hand, they have all of this pastoral care to look after their beneficiaries. On the other hand, every time they're registering this data, it could have implications for the financial services that they're providing. If there's inconsistencies in the database, or if it's sort of showing up kind of differently on the end of the insurer than it is on the state, that can have downstream effects. One kind of example of another claims denial, where the beneficiaries had their children registered in the kind of database, but it was only captured imperfectly. So only one of the children was kind of registered. A terrible accident, and they had to make a claim for kind of two of the kids in the family. But since they weren't registered in the database, the insurance company says, like, well, you know, nothing we can do. But of course, the whole community sort of knows this. So they're like, even if the insurance company doesn't know them, like, we all know you, right? So they go on the radio and do a fundraiser to hold the funeral, and within 12 hours collect $400 to be able to kind of have the funeral and to be able to support the family as they're kind of grieving this terrible accident. We see this also on the sort of downstream side of insurance in terms of budgeting, where most of the work that the Paraguayan state was doing to try to manage how expensive this program is, right? Because they're the ones who are fully subsidizing it, and they're kind of worried about how expensive it is, rather than going back to the insurance company and saying, we need to negotiate on premiums, or we need to kind of make sure that you're actually, you know, paying out the claims that are due to the people that you're insuring. Instead, they push this back onto beneficiaries and kind of clients. So they would hold, like, I went to dozens of workshops where the most common discussion wasn't about how do you make your claim to the insurance company and make sure they pay it. It was, how do you keep the cost of your funeral down?
But that seems almost contradictory from what the state is actually trying to do.
I think that's right. And I think it goes to the heart of a contradiction in the aims of the program itself. On the one hand, it promises to be this important social benefit, right, for beneficiaries, and that was an important aim. But it had a second aim, and that's something that we talk about less, and that's the aim to expand the reach of financial markets and kind of deepen the kind of efficacy of financial services in Paraguay. So those are two aims that are happening at the same time, to support the financial services industry and also to support beneficiaries. Too often, those are mutually contradictory kind of aims, right? And it's telling that when the cards are on the table, they tilt towards supporting the financial services industry rather than advocating for beneficiaries.
Okay. So what you're describing now is like data, the system meeting the complexity of everyday lives and families. But there's also this thing that you both of you talk about, where this data is actually stored and who has access to it.
In the Brazilian case, I mean, there's just so much data being collected. I mean, there's like a massive financial surveillance going on, right? Because every single transaction that people make is being registered and stored with the central bank. But there's a huge sort of digital infrastructure around like collecting all this different type of data and how it is then sold to credit bureaus and processed, analyzed, and then sold on to financial institutions making use of this data to do the risk assessment, right? So even cleaning your name, yes, that will do some improvements in terms of getting access to new credit and being able to buy things on credit, but it still hurts people's credit score. And that's something because it's very recent that that millions of people, and especially women, have had access to this type of credit. This is very new, and so a lot of people, they don't know about this, and it's very new for them to then learn, oh, so five years down the line, this is going to affect my life.
What's really interesting about the life insurance conundrum, as it were, in Paraguay, is that, again, it's this public-private partnership, right, which leads to lots of questions that even the actors themselves in this kind of network of policies and financial services are asking about: where is this data kind of stored? And it raises really thorny questions for the policymakers and insurance agents themselves. What we don't know in this whole system is how much data is being handed over from the Paraguayan state to private providers in order to do the underwriting for kind of these policies. And that's a total black box. That's not publicly available information. And the policymakers themselves who are working in social welfare themselves are very unclear about kind of how much access the private insurer has to their public kind of databases. So on the one hand, they said in interviews that given this situation where insurers weren't willing to cover low-income people, he said, what did we do? We helped. We sort of helped them with the data. That's, on the one hand, good because it provides a really important new resource, life insurance coverage for people who didn't have it. On the other hand, we really don't know kind of what sort of data is and on what sort of kind of basis with what sorts of privacy protections are flowing those public welfare roles into kind of private databases.
This adventure that the tech companies are currently on in countries like Paraguay and Brazil is obviously bringing about a lot of new possibilities. And if you are a person that needs money to feed your family, giving up some information about yourself might not seem as the worst thing in the world. So at the end of the day, these solutions seem to be here to stay. So what can we do to remedy some of these long-term consequences for people that you, both of you, have just described?
Yeah, and I think that what you're really pointing to and what really moves across these two cases is a need for much better consumer protection and the ability of people to kind of make claims against the companies that are holding their data and better mechanisms to kind of actually get a response if there is something kind of wrong. So that consumer protection is kind of really important and really kind of shows that there is an important regulatory kind of aspect to this and one that often gets sort of swept aside as we're kind of rushing for new tech. And in Paraguay, as well as Brazil, I think we alluded to at the beginning of the podcast that both of these places and many contexts in the global south are really a sandbox for kind of tech companies to play in, to experiment with kind of new tech. And rather than hitting pause and saying, okay, maybe we do need some more regulation before we deepen or extend kind of these services, too often the solution that comes to hand is more tech. For example, kind of in Paraguay, when there were problems around kind of getting people payouts in a timely fashion, instead of going back to the insurance company and saying, hey, what's going on with your claims denials? Instead, they said, ah, I know. How about mobile money? We'll kind of use that as a kind of new way to kind of get claims kind of quickly. It doesn't actually solve the problem, right? If the problem is with the insurer and not paying the money, then that doesn't actually resolve the kind of consumer protection issue. So the kind of, I think, end of the story here is that when we're talking about consumer protection, we're also talking about taking seriously some of those social obligations and responsibilities that people are already kind of negotiating, whether it's kind of trying to get a realistic portrait of their kind of social kind of life and kind of social context to be reflected in some of this data, and to get a genuine response from kind of companies that are also, in many cases, really hostile to having that kind of conversation. So instead of, you know, hitting pause and actually having that tough conversation around, okay, so what are the responsibilities that some of these companies owe to their consumers, the jump too often is to quote-unquote solve the problem with new tech developments and see that ever-proliferating kind of experiment with kind of new tech that we can roll out in places like Paraguay and Brazil.
Yeah, and this is also a tough battle, right? Because, I mean, not that all fintechs in Brazil are thriving businesses that make huge amounts of profits, but in general, the banking sector has been making, you know, record-breaking profits over the last years because of credit. And yeah, all the profit that they make from offering credit. So this is a very powerful sector. And I mean, they are not interested in a lot of the regulation that would protect consumers. And the consumers that are affected the hardest by this lack of regulation are the low-income population, and they don't know where to go, and they don't often, I mean, have their time or energy to do that either. I think one of the reasons that it doesn't spark outrage is because this is seen, this is perceived as an individual problem. I mean, so if people haven't paid up their debt, that's on them. They're bad payers. It's a moral, you know, problem that they aren't doing their duty to be the good payer and pay up what they owe.
That's it for today's episode. Please join us when we return with a fresh new episode on the Deez podcast.